Okay, let's get started. We're a little bit late, and I apologize. My name is Beverly Crawford, and I'm one of the co-directors of the European Union Center for Excellence here on the Berkeley campus. And we are delighted today to have Professor Barry Eichengreen speak to us on the crisis, the euro, and the options, the case of Hungary. I know that we all know Professor Eichengreen, but I just want to repeat some of your achievements here. Barry Eichengreen is the George C. Pardee and Helen N. Pardee Professor of Economics and Political Science at UC Berkeley. He's been here since 1987. And he has written classic works on the European economy, European economic history, world economic history, Europe and Asia, monetary policy, world monetary systems, and his latest book is China, Asia, and the New World Economy. But he's written about Latin America and bond markets, and he just had a paperback edition of The European Economy Since 1945, came out in 2008. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he writes politically for everything.
Thank you, Beth. I told Beth she should introduce me by saying you're on, but she insisted. So it's great to see the European Union Center of Excellence doing so excellently well. I don't get audiences like this in the economics department. So I've done a little bit of bait and switch. Bev, I think, wanted me to talk more about the euro and the crisis. Now that the crisis part is over, or so we think, I'm going to talk about these issues, but in the context of a country and an economy where the crisis is very, very much not over, namely Hungary. So Hungary, for me, is emblematic of the problems in Central and Eastern Europe. This is the part of the world that has been hit hardest by the crisis. So we think we have it bad in the United States because the GDP has fallen by 3%. In Hungary, it's fallen in the last year by about 10%. Hungary is a bigger country than, say, Latvia, which many people have heard about in this connection recently, where output has fallen twice as fast, even. But in a sense, some of the critical problems are similar. So I think Hungary's case is interesting for thinking about the broader regions, broader problems of the region as well. The other thing that's striking, I think, is that the resemblances between the current crisis in Central and Eastern Europe and the Asian financial crisis of 10 plus years ago. And I'm going to suggest that the run-up to the crises, to the two crises, were indeed very similar, but that the outcome and the response will turn out to be rather different, but in ways that are not terribly reassuring for the Europeanists and the Eastern Europeanists amongst us. Finally, I will get around to talking about the euro and the implications of all this for Hungary's adoption of the euro in particular. So, gosh, I didn't know the screen was going to be so small, but so it goes. The point of this table is to document those very pronounced similarities between the run-up to the Asian financial crisis starting 4 years before the event, 1993 or so, running up to the crisis, and the same thing running up to 2008 in Central and Eastern Europe. So were you able to see this table, you would observe that Asia then, Central and Eastern Europe now, like Asia then, was running big current account deficits in the run-up to the crisis. And relying on a lot of foreign capital to finance them. Central and Eastern Europe recently, like Asia 10 years ago, was having a big party. They were allowing their real exchange rate to appreciate. They were consuming a lot of local goods. Their own exports were becoming increasingly uncompetitive on world markets. People were sounding alarm bells. Either they weren't sounding them loudly enough, or someone wasn't listening. The reason they weren't listening probably was that this big party was financing something of a boom in Central and Eastern Europe, robust growth rates leading up to the crisis, as in Asia 10 years earlier. Central and Eastern Europe in 2007-2008 was, however, highly vulnerable to something going wrong, just like Asia 10 years earlier. So the amount of foreign money they required, depicted here by the current account deficit, the trade deficit basically, plus the short-term external debt, the money of 12 months maturity or less that they borrowed previously and had to roll over and refinance, those were big numbers comparable to the situation in Asia, the baby blue bars 10 years earlier. So now the bill comes due in the same way that it came due in Asia before. The Baltics, Latvia and its neighbors are the ones that have suffered the most, but Central and Eastern Europe has suffered as well. And as I said, Hungary is looking this year at an economic contraction approaching 10% of GDP. So there are these parallels, but as all the Europeanists in the room would insist, Europe is different, and Hungary is different in particular. Hungary is deeply integrated into Europe. The region as a whole now is deeply integrated into Europe, and it has the distinguishing characteristic that the vast majority of the banking in Central and Eastern Europe is done by the subsidiaries of Western European banks. So there is one Hungarian bank of consequence, for example, but all the other banks are subsidiaries of Swiss, Italian, Austrian, I believe, banks. So you look across the region and you see foreign-owned banking coming from a variety of places, dominating. The other distinguishing characteristic of Central and Eastern Europe is that there are now a wide variety of different exchange rate regimes. So some countries have rigid pegs to the euro, Latvia, Estonia, Bulgaria. Some countries have exchange rates that now adjust to one some extent or another, Hungary, Poland, the Czech Republic. Some have successfully adopted the euro, Slovenia and Slovakia, and their responses and their problems, therefore, are respectively quite different. So I will talk about the importance of those different exchange rate regimes, et cetera, in a few minutes. Hungary, of course, is a special case. For me, what I mean by that is that it has not displayed the typical response of an emerging market to the crisis. So what have emerging markets as a group done? Well, they were hit hard, especially late last year and early this year, by the freezing up of financial markets, disappearance of trade credit, the inventory liquidation that producers around the world engaged in. But they've bounced back subsequently quite robustly. So economic growth in emerging markets is quite good again, as it was in Asia 10 years ago. So they had a serious crisis in 1998. By 1999, they were growing again robustly. So Hungary is different. They're contracting quite viciously this year, and they expect their economy to continue to contract next year. So maybe if they're lucky, they'll start growing again in 2011. Not only do they have a severe, very severe recession, but this looks like it's going to be an extended recession as well. So the central bank's forecast is that growth is going to be negative 7 or 8% this year, probably too optimistic. Growth is going to be negative 1% in 2010, probably too optimistic. Again, a very disturbing response by the standards of the typical emerging markets. So we and even by the standards of Central and Eastern Europe. So the IMF released its latest forecast for 2010 a couple of weeks ago, and it sees Central and Eastern Europe as a whole growing in 2010. Again, not so hungry, and it will, and a large part of my tale will be why not. So where to start? I think that at a superficial level, the reasons for the contrast are pretty obvious. Other emerging markets have been able to apply countercyclical monetary and fiscal policies. They've been able to do, their central banks have been able to do what the Fed has done, cut interest rates to zero, and their governments have been able to do what our government has done, namely apply fiscal stimulus. So with the disappearance of external demand, they were have been able to stabilize their economies by boosting domestic demand, just as we've attempted to do. For the first time really in their history, this is the first crisis affecting emerging markets that I can think of where they have had the policy space, they've had the room for maneuver to cut interest rates and to apply fiscal stimulus, not so hungry. The reason for that, I think, is again, obvious at a superficial level. Hungary has inherited large budget deficits as a result of the party in the first half of the present decade. And in addition, they have large currency mismatches that constrain the central bank. And I'll come back in a moment and explain exactly what that means and how it came about. So let me set the stage by reminding you of the crisis and how it's affected emerging markets and Hungary in particular. The first thing that they felt was this massive shock to global exports. So here I have a figure that depicts the dramatic drop in import demand by the United States and the euro area. All of a sudden, these export-dependent economies couldn't export anymore because nobody was buying. And you see that very much in the Hungarian data. So here's the red line is the volume of exports, and boy, do they plummet, especially after Lehman Brothers. Similarly, there's been a massive shock to global financial markets. So this is the amount of capital that had been flowing into emerging markets up through 2007, 2008, and especially 2009 are not good years. It's going to be 2011 before capital begins to flow into emerging markets on net, again, according to IMF forecasts. Again, this light gray line it is emergency assistance from the Fund and the World Bank and the EBRD and so forth. And you could see that if you could see this figure for Hungary as well. So this is what happened to their stock market. This is what happened to their government bond market. It's an interesting issue that I think we can understand why in the United States, you know, it was the other way around and it was the equity market that really tanked. But you can see here really the impact of foreign money fleeing to safety, and when it fled out of Hungary. So one result of that was that the currencies of emerging markets from Korea to Poland down the line depreciated pretty sharply, especially in the second half of 2008. And you can see that collapse of the exchange rate in the red line for Hungary as well was something of a bounce back recently as conditions have normalized a little bit. So the general idea is you know, what goes down comes back up, and in other parts of the world, in Indonesia, China, Singapore, Korea, in Asia, in other words, there really is kind of a V-shaped recovery once again, this time, as there was after 1998. But, and why is that? I think not so much because markets are naturally self-correcting, as because, as I said before, emerging markets this time have had the policy space, the capacity to take stabilizing action. Why? Because they have been running current account surpluses rather than deficits for the last 10 odd years. Because they have accumulated a large buffer or war chest of international reserves. Because they have been running budget surpluses rather than budget deficits, so that when it became necessary, they were able to cut taxes and or increase government spending without exciting the markets. So, you know, this is the swing in fiscal policy in the advanced economies. You know the story of the United States. What emerging markets have done as a group is a bit more modest, but very impressive by historical standards, nonetheless. But not to the same extent everywhere. So who has room for maneuver? The answer is countries that are toward the left on the horizontal axis. They have relatively low levels of public debt to GDP. And countries that are relatively high up on the vertical axis, where the fiscal balance is in surplus rather than deficit. So you want to be up here rather than down here. And here is poor old Hungary in the same neighborhood as the Philippines and Egypt and Ireland, not a group of countries that you would want to keep company with under present circumstances. People who know the distinction between net public debt and gross public debt will understand why Singapore is misplaced in this figure. It doesn't belong out there. But the point is, there are very few countries to the right of Hungary, as I'm drawing a line with my hand, who have less capacity fiscally to respond than this country does. And if you look across countries, you can see that this policy response really has made a difference. So these figures are from the IMF's recent World Economic Outlook, and it asks, when you have a crisis, by how much does your output fall relative to trend? And the answer is, if you have a strong external position, a lot less than if you have a weak external position. If you have a strong government budget, by a lot less than if you have a weak government budget. So that seems to be a pretty robust regularity, perhaps not surprising. So this response wasn't possible in Hungary. The country entered the crisis, as I said, with a very large budget deficit already approaching, maybe not by our standards in the U.S., but by almost anybody else's, approaching 8% of GDP in 2007. And they already have the debt burden, the ratio of public debt to GDP that we're aiming for. They already have more than we're hoping for by the time we in the U.S. dig ourselves out of the current crisis. So they already have a debt to GDP ratio approaching 90%. Investors are already worried about where they're going to generate the tax revenues to service this debt. And they would be even more excited if they heard that Hungary was going to continue to run deficits on this order indefinitely. So what did Hungary do? It negotiated temporary assistance from the IMF, and as part of that agreement, it's now engaged in the process that we happily call fiscal consolidation, bringing those deficits down by increasing value-added taxation, reforming the pension system, freezing the salaries of civil servants, et cetera, so the goal here is a deficit of only 4 or 5% in the current year, only 3% next year, only 2% of GDP in the year after. So when a normal country would want to be applying more fiscal stimulus because private demand is collapsing, Hungary finds itself in the opposite position. And it's not clear that this situation is sustainable. So external demand, especially in Hungary's markets, mainly Western Europe, is still weak. Unemployment is on the order of 10%, and dissatisfaction with the incumbent socialist-led government is growing. There's an election coming next spring where everyone apparently believes that the right-wing opposition will win, and what it will do in terms of fiscal consolidation is not clear. It hasn't announced its intentions other than to assert that it's opposed to everything that the incumbent government is doing. In practice, governments are able to pull this kind of thing off, move from a situation where they start with a big budget deficit toward balance only when they can depreciate the currency. They can only do it if they can replace the domestic demand that they're eliminating with external demand. Otherwise, you end up with high unemployment and you end up with a political backlash against the fiscal consolidation program. So the way other countries have solved this problem before, Ireland, the Netherlands in the 1980s when they had big budget deficits, they depreciated the currency, crowded in external demand to replace the internal demand that they were eliminating. So you might ask how we're going to do fiscal consolidation in the United States, but that's another talk. So as I'm about to show you, that's not possible in Hungary. So that's the dilemma and the problem of sustainability here. So one more little bit before I get there is that, of course, and closely related is the other thing that emerging markets have been able to do this time is to cut interest rates in response to the crisis. So here I have a picture for, of all countries, Korea, because it was the famous case in 1997-98 where they had to raise interest rates in response to the crisis. Now, with only a somewhat stronger external position, they were able to cut interest rates because they were not as dependent as last time on foreign capital, and they didn't have the mismatch problem that I promised you I will get to next. So, you know, Korea and other emerging markets were able to cut interest rates. Hungary, look what it had to do after Lehman Brothers. So what is the problem, the mismatch problem? The problem is that 70% of the mortgages of Hungarian households are in foreign currency. They are in euros or more typically in Swiss francs. So if the foreign is depreciated to crowd in exports and the foreign buys fewer Swiss francs, the incomes of those households don't go as far in terms of keeping current on their mortgages. So it's heavily mortgage debt. There's also a lot of corporate debt in Swiss francs and car loans in Swiss francs as well. So this is a big constraint on what the central bank can do. It can't allow the currency to decline to crowd in exports. It can't loosen monetary policy and in that way limit the rise in unemployment without creating very serious problems for homeowners. So I just saw this last week in The Economist magazine. These bars are the share of foreign currency mortgages as a percentage of the total. In 2003, the light bar, and 2008, the dark one. Here is Hungary with 70% of mortgages denominated in foreign currency, and the only countries that are worse off from that point of view are Latvia and Estonia. Again, company that you wouldn't want to keep. So here's the story about the corporate side. You basically see the same kind of thing. Lots of the bank loans taken out by non-financial enterprises in Hungary are denominated in Swiss francs as well. So I've explained, this is a bad thing. The central bank is severely constrained as a result in how it can respond to the crisis, and as a result there are real questions about what's going to happen in Hungary now more generally. So the question everyone will be asking themselves is, how did this come about? How could a country allow itself to get into a situation where 70% of the mortgages are denominated in foreign currency. So an American shouldn't lecture anyone about management of the mortgage market, but I can say a few words at least about it. Until recently, if you took out a 15-year mortgage, which is the typical term of a mortgage in Hungary, if you took it out in Swiss francs, you paid 6%. If you took it out in forint, you paid 14%. So if you weren't aware that the exchange rate could move against you, taking out Swiss francs loans looked like a pretty good deal. And many people were not aware, this being the point, that the exchange rate could move against them because the central bank didn't let it move much until 2008. It managed it within a band, which basically meant that homeowners were oblivious to the possibility that the currency could move by a large amount. And if you go back to this bar graph here, who are the other countries with lots of foreign currency denominated mortgages? The answer is other countries that manage their exchange rates very tightly. It's not a coincidence. In other words, those other countries being, again, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Romania. Poland is very different, and Poland has a very different exchange rate regime. Bulgaria is not different. So that kind of suggests that with the right kind of regulation, maybe you can do something about this problem. So what will happen? I'll talk about this very briefly, and then I will stop in terms of monetary and fiscal policies, in terms of financial regulation, in terms of euro adoption, and then I'll give you some scenarios about how it all might play out. I think in terms of monetary and fiscal policies, they are likely to stay the course, and I think they have little choice but to try, given the adverse inheritance. The fiscal situation was out of control and needs to be reined in, albeit at an inopportune time. The central bank is trying to bring interest rates down to encourage borrowing and investment, but it's going to have to do so very gradually. It would like the exchange rate to decline a little bit to encourage exports, but it can't do more than a little because of the foreign exchange exposure of the corporate and household sectors. So you put that together with the possibility that growth will be slow in Western Europe, and it's hard to do more than hold your breath and hope that things will turn out okay. Last week, the central bank governor announced his intention of imposing new regulations on foreign currency borrowing. So officials are aware of the problem that I've been describing, and among other things, they would impose much higher capital requirements on banks that extended foreign currency loans. They would provide a financial disincentive for banks to engage in that practice. They would include stricter, down payment requirements, loan-to-value ratios, and stuff like that, if you take out a foreign currency loan. All of this is closing the barn door after the horse is out, of course. But again, it's an indication of the kind of measures that a country is capable of taking to deal with these kind of problems. The crisis has more generally heightened the enthusiasm of European countries that are not yet in the euro area to enter. And that is certainly the case in policy circles in Hungary. Entering the euro area is a way of dealing with the currency mismatch problem, the Swiss franc dimension notwithstanding. It ensures you of access to emergency credit from the European Central Bank when you need it. So Hungary is not in the euro area. It didn't get emergency credit from the ECB. It turned actually to the Swiss National Bank for reasons that are pretty obvious when you think about the Swiss franc dimension and the exposure of Swiss banks. But it wants to be sure that when it needs emergency help, it can get it. And the only way to be sure of that is to enter the euro area. So they're committed, I think, to getting rid of their IMF program in 2011, becoming a member of the exchange rate mechanism with its wide bands, satisfying the fiscal and other criteria for adopting the euro, and hopefully doing so by 2013. And I think recent problems have reinforced their resolve to do so. They're going to have a credit boom problem to deal with. If they get their act together, eventually interest rates will come down. There'll be lots of borrowing again, and they're going to have to manage that problem as well. It's worth thinking finally about what they should do if the worst happens. So the worst in this context, as I explained earlier, is that budget cuts depress domestic demand further, leading to further deficits, requiring further budget cuts in a vicious spiral. Meanwhile, expectations that the conservative opposition will win next year's election will mean that foreign capital is not flowing in to the country. So one thing we know with confidence about financial crises is they almost always occur just before elections. Hungary's election is coming in April, I believe. The large overhang of foreign currency denominated debt will prevent the exchange rate from, prevent the central bank from doing anything about this problem and letting the exchange rate decline significantly. And without more export demand jump-started by a sharp depreciation of the currency, public disaffection with these policies of austerity will build as well. So what to do? I think there are three conceivable alternatives. One is internal devaluation, a social pact to cut wages and make the country's exports more competitive through that channel. There are some small countries that have done that in earlier decades. But this is hard to do in a bigger country, I think, like Hungary. The second option would be external devaluation. And here again, as I've argued, the benefits are going to be limited by the foreign currency debt problem. And the third option is to try to deal with this inheritance of Swiss franc debt. So academics can concoct schemes whereby the government might compel households to exchange their Swiss franc mortgages for foreign mortgages, or maybe entice them into doing so by reducing the amount of the principal. The government, of course, would then just have on its balance sheet the problem that households had on their balance sheets previously. So it would have to do something about that problem. It would have to be able to negotiate somehow with the foreign banks that extended those loans, you know, and that might be easier with one government bargaining on the Hungarian side than millions of individual households. But I think it's questionable whether this can be done without damaging the country and the government's reputation on international capital markets. Does it send a bad signal about the future path of the currency? We're getting rid of the Swiss franc debt so we can push the currency down. That may not be happily received elsewhere. So what do I think is going to happen? I think most likely they're going to try to do a combination of options number one and two, hold their breath that things turn out well and the global economy recovers. So will it work? Only time will tell. So let me stop there.
So Barry will take his own questions.
What was it about Hungary's situation that made it have only a deficit while the other emerging markets were having surpluses, whether the hangover from the communist era that was filtering through stupid management purely, or what was it that got in the situation?
Well, other emerging markets, if one means in this context Asia, you know, Asia went through the once burned, twice shy kind of phenomenon. They'd had a big crisis 10 years earlier that they were desperate to avoid repetition of under any circumstances. Within Central and Eastern Europe itself, I guess I don't have a clear sense in my mind about why one group of countries, of which Hungary was a member, had big chronic budget deficits, while some others were quicker to get their fiscal act together than maybe the other people in the United States.
Could you compare the Hungarian situation to that of Iceland? It sounds, and this sort of foreign currency denominated debt sounds familiar. Is it basically an analogous case, or does Iceland have more room to maneuver?
So I you know, the only thing that Iceland and Hungary have in common that occurs to me is, you know, people are blowing up their Land Rovers in both cases because that's the only way to get the insurance money on the foreign currency car loan. You know, I think seriously they're very, very, very different cases, and that, you know, Iceland had its own banks and the problem was that they expanded abroad, where Hungary is kind of in the opposite situation, where they don't have much of a banking system even domestically except for the foreign subsidiaries of the Western European banks. What else would I say about that? Big parties in both cases in the run-up to the West.
I have two questions. One of them is regarding how you, what your assessment of the situation, social policy Hungary is, and if they're able to cut the deficit in the way you outlined it, because they already had riots there, I believe, when first IMF came to town. And the other question is, you, maybe I misread you there, but I felt like you were saying that the emerging markets in Asia did a good thing by building up currency reserves and by trying to protect themselves against the situation of a global crisis. But on the other hand, that's also on the global macroeconomy. If you look at it from a global perspective, that it's an imbalance and that actually everybody trying to insure themselves against something which I think there could be much more efficient ways of organizing it. So I was wondering what your thoughts are on that.
So I agree with the second point completely. I think it is a fact that countries that kept their powder dry were in a better position to respond to the crisis. So that means that you have monetary credibility, so that the central bank could cut interest rates without exciting the markets. That you had budget surpluses and low debt, rather than the opposite. And absent a better mechanism, you had a big war chest of dollars that you could use when dollar funding for trade and other things dried up. So I'm certainly a believer that there were externalities for the system that resulted from all those policies, especially the last one, and that there has to be a better way. But in the absence of a better way, would I recommend to countries don't accumulate reserves? You know, so, you know, we're trying to devise a better way to do collective insurance of this sort. We're still a long way from doing it. In terms of swinging budget cuts and all that, you know, when I was in Hungary last week, I was only in Budapest, and you don't see the distress there. You're told about it, and it's presumably much more evident elsewhere. You know, I don't know what to say in addition to what I said before, that there is a real danger here of kind of a vicious spiral. You cut social programs and you get a political backlash against that austerity unless people see light at the end of the tunnel. And it's not clear under these particular circumstances that they will see it.
I was willing to use the euro countries are restricted to follow the Stability and Growth Act, and that really restricts them from, adopting certain types of fiscal policies. And as a result of that, many countries in the eurozone have been violating the treaty role of the Growth and Stability Pact. And would it necessarily help Hungary in terms of, creating, yes, it would benefit from the stability of the euro and the access that we would have with the ECB, but would it necessarily be a dramatic, beneficial option for them to be a part of the euro?
So there were a couple of different points there. The first one about have countries in Europe been constrained in the crisis, in how they could respond by the Stability and Growth Pact? The answer is no, that the rules are out the window, as they are in many other respects.
Well, the Commission is actually going to launch a new discipline procedure.
Right, and I'm holding my breath for the outcome. So, I actually think it's a good thing that extraordinary circumstances require an extraordinary response so that everybody has looked the other way effectively during the crisis. Has been appropriate. Do I think that it would be of great benefit to a country like Hungary to adopt the euro? It would be uncomfortable in a lot of ways, but I think what the crisis has shown is the only thing more uncomfortable than adopting the euro is not adopting the euro. So a case in point would be Denmark, which is out. And when the ECB was cutting interest rates and all that, the central bank there had to raise rates because, they were a little tiny economy. Nobody was fleeing for safety to the Danish krona. So they had to, do exactly the wrong thing to keep their currency from crashing in the crisis. The economists have, the theory of optimum currency areas and all this about normal times, but I think what we've seen is during abnormal times, during a crisis, there is safety in numbers when your currency is a real global currency that everybody uses. Nobody wanted to use Danish krona in the crisis, and the central bank couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah. Understand how this mortgage crisis came about? Was it some predatory lending, or how could it be that such a large proportion of the mortgages were designated in the foreign currency? And so it's not a situation that could happen here.
You're a Swiss bank, and your funding, your deposits, are in Swiss francs. You want your loans to be in Swiss francs too. So you are, quote, safe, right? That's what a prudent bank generally will do. And I think, they were interested in their own balance sheets. They weren't interested in the health and safety of the household sector in Hungary. I think, we've learned that banks don't exactly always get it right. So they may have been naive in terms of this exchange rate problem as well, and didn't fully take on board the idea that if the foreign depreciated by a large amount, a whole lot of people would start defaulting on those Swiss franc mortgages. So who is to blame, quote unquote, here? It takes two to tango. So I think the banks should have known better, the borrowers should have known better, and the government should have been reminding everybody concerned on a day-to-day basis by letting the exchange rate move, and probably more importantly, regulating the mortgage market vigorously in the manner now, long after the fact, they're proposing to do.
Ben, would you be willing to comment on Germany's unwillingness to bail out Hungary, because there was some talk of this you know, early on in the EU Commission and in the EU Council, and the Germans said, no, absolutely not, we will not help. And maybe as sort of a regional, as a strong regional power, that might, maybe that should have been Germany's role.
Well, so one of the interesting things that we've seen in the crisis is that when an EU country, be it Hungary or Latvia or Romania or whomever, is in distress and needs help, it's uncomfortable for the neighbors to set down conditions. And it's probably especially uncomfortable for the Germans to start telling, you know, the neighbors what to do, given, you know, we'll only loan you money if you do the following things. So it follows that when there is that need, they outsource the function to the IMF, and then they top up the kitty by providing some more money. So, that seems to be the way things work. And more generally, it's the way things work. If you look in Asia, where they have the Chiang Mai Initiative and all these fancy financial supports, when push comes to shove, they won't loan money unless there's an IMF program in place because of historical sensitivities.
Mm-hmm. Is this like a second guessing about Swiss monetary policy? Is there some weird belief that they were too lax and weren't paying attention to asset?
Well, it's had two consequences. One, I think, is that the Swiss realize they've been derelict in how they regulated their banking system, and I think that probably extends to the subsidiaries. These are not all Swiss banks. These are a variety of foreign banks that have extended the loans. To the extent that they're denominated in Swiss francs, the value of the franc becomes important. So one of the things that happened earlier this year was that the Swiss tried to get the franc to decline, and one explanation for that was, you know, they had the same problem of needing to export more, given the domestic demand that everybody else had. But the other aspect of it was that this would be helpful for countries like Hungary, where there was the problem of exporting anything to get. So you're asking me to define what a currency mismatch is, or to explain how it came about?
Both.
So a currency mismatch is, for the household sector, is when the currency your income is in and the currency your debts are in are mismatched. That's all. They get wages in foreign and they have to pay their debts, which are denominated in Swiss francs or euros. So when the exchange rate moves, the burden can become much heavier. And how did it come about? We kind of had that conversation. The banks were reckless, the borrowers were reckless, and the government should, you know, which has allowed the exchange rate to move more freely since early 2008, if I have my dates correct, should have done that starting a lot earlier when those debts were building up.
In this country, it's a lot of the rhetoric is devoted to the real economy versus the hyper-financialized economy of Main Street versus Wall Street. And I was wondering, in the case of these exports, what does Hungary export, and does that matter under, this condition? Reasonably, when conditions were right, did we have something to export?
I don't know offhand what the four or five top categories of exports are, but they export a variety of parts and components for a whole series of Western European industries. So I think the best way of putting it is they're part of that supply chain the, you know, the, they're hooked into the German and Western European manufacturing network. So somebody who has internet access can. Well, so somebody who has internet access can tell us what proportions are what.
I have a question related to the whole notion of default, mortgage default. The reason being because Hungary raised the discount rate about a year ago by 300 basis points in order to defend the war. Everybody expected that the foreign would collapse instead of the foreign by the government. And the Hungarian National Bank says that even if the foreign would depreciate by about 30%, up to 340%, the default rate would be only 6 to 8%, and they have cushioned up to 15%. They use most of the IMF money to shore up OPP, as you mentioned, which is important. So the question is, don't we export our view of the subprime crisis, the U.S. subprime crisis, and the new situation? And well, because they didn't have a real estate bubble, real estate didn't appreciate the way it did here, especially in California. Or is it a real, the Hungarians say, hey, we can deal with this?
So, you know, my as I said, my guess is that they will probably in the end deal with it rather than restructuring mortgage debt through some kind of new government agency or the like. So I think that's right. If I understand correctly, the other aspect of the situation there that's really different from our own is, you know, we have these no recourse mortgage loans where you can walk away from your mortgage debt and keep your other assets, and if I'm correct, that's not the case in Hungary. So, you know, people are going to swallow hard and try to keep current on these debts as much as they can. They're going to have to compress their other spending. That's going to represent a bigger transfer abroad. It's not going to be good for the economy. But, you know, I guess my guess would be the same as yours or the central banks. I'm not sure whose views you were just, maybe both were just characterizing. But it's, you know, it still will mean a very difficult adjustment. So I think for the, you know, as I said before, what is striking about a number of other crises going in Asia 10 years ago, back 10 years, or in Asia now is the V-shaped recovery. This kind of story does not suggest a V-shaped recovery in Hungary. More likely they will stumble through the current problem given the devices they currently have. There won't be a whole lot of support from policy, and there won't be an early recovery.
Ultimately, it appears to be a very high level of integration. Especially the banking system. The comparison that comes into mind is the one with Turkey. When the Turkish economy was hit by crisis in 2001, the crisis, the one solution was to direct the focus on the banking sector with numerous banks, which included numerous banks, and just eliminate large numbers of banks with the consensus of the large banks and with the consensus of society, because the defaulting of the banks, smaller or more medium-sized banks, were hurting the people who borrowed heavily. And then the integration into the global banking sector happened after the crisis
was over. So I would distinguish two things here. One is the regulation of the banking system. You know, it seems to me that the kind of regulations that are being talked about now is are examples of what should have been done previously. But that's different from thinking and talking so much about the integration of the banking system. So even if, you know, Hungary relies on foreign banks, it can impose a variety of regulations on what those foreign banks are able to do when they engage in domestic lending. There can be a problem, obviously, if corporates go offshore to borrow, and, you know, that's something that the government has to try to regulate in some way, shape, or form as well. What's another thing that is striking about the crisis is that countries that are integrated into the global financial system, in the sense that their banking systems are dominated by the subsidiaries of foreign banks, lending has held up better in those countries than in others. So when you have your own banking system, your own banking system is typically in pretty deep distress. After Lehman Brothers, people worried that if your banking system was dominated, I don't know, Swedish banks in Latvia or Western European banks in Hungary, that those subsidiaries would cut and run and repatriate all their money. It didn't happen. To the contrary. So I think, you have a point that that regulation and integration are related to one another, but I think the problem, and here I am talking through the lens of the subprime crisis, the problem there, as here, is not the financial integration. The problem is the inadequacy of regulation.
But when you have this level of integration, doesn't it sort of narrow the space for regulation?
Yeah. So, as I acknowledge, it does. And the issue is, can you still close the barn door when it's the subsidiaries of foreign banks that are making mortgage loans to your households? And I think you can.
Yes. I am from Latvia, and I'm, of course, quite worried to hear from you about the situation there. Can we explain some of the situation in Latvia, that there is no expert, financial expert around to handle the situation properly?
So,
no matter how ingenious you are, you cannot solve the problem.
So please don't ask me what Latvia's principal exports.
Eggs and bacon.
No, I don't think the problem is lack of economic expertise. Maybe the correlation goes the other way. I think the Latvian authorities know as well as anyone does what their options are. And you know, they're in even more extreme case than this one, where the inheritance and lack of budgetary discipline did earlier. So that's been now with very, very few options. So, we were all reading last week about how option number three, which the Hungarian officials aren't really talking about, the president talked about whether it was going to be done in Latvia last week. Like, so there, where the situation is even more extreme, where option number two would be a big farm down for the authorities, and option number one is being tried, but there's only so much you can do. They are talking about the third, more radical alternative. So we will see.
But sometimes, if it is, can create money.
Well,
think of the situation in Germany 1923 with runaway inflation, and the German people were just becoming totally desperate. And then a genius from America came, Horace Greeley Schacht, Dr. Schacht, and he managed in short time to stabilize the currency and business started going as usual in Germany. And everyone was grateful to this great man, this ingenious man from the U.S.
And do you remember who the finance minister who presided over the Austrian hyperinflation was?
I don't know.
She was a chief lady.
There's
expertise here on both sides. Mm-hmm. You know, where the economists in the room are in this business indeed because they think they have something to contribute to the policy for the better, but it's not only the knowledge, it's the ability to implement it in timely fashion, which means, you know, last year and the year before and the year before.
I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the universe of cases that's represented by Hungary. So you identified the two causes as kind of large deficits and large currency mismatches. Is that something sort of any country with a peg or a currency board has, or is it, you know, East European countries? Is there a sort of pattern that you would associate with that dilemma?
It's the combination of a rigid exchange rate and lots of dependence on external finance. So there are a couple of countries in Latin America, Ecuador, El Salvador, with rigid exchange rates that haven't relied on external finance and don't have the same kind of mismatch problems. If we go way back to that four quadrant diagram, I don't know quite what generalization I would make about, you know, who has run conservative, prudent fiscal policies over the years and who hasn't. There's a big literature, you know, in economics and political science on what determines the fiscal stance. And I don't know that I can summarize it in a way that really makes sense of that diagram. Part of the story certainly is recent experience with the crisis, but that's certainly not the whole story. Our hostess has left the room. Should I say thank you in her absence?